Thank you, Kirsten, for the introduction. And also thanks to Tom and Anselm for inviting me. It's been a huge pleasure to be in that working group with all of you together. And before I start my talk, I just wanted to say that this is very much a work in progress, so it will be a bit rough at the edges, and you have to bear with me when it gets a bit convoluted. And also a quick note on the presentation. You will be seeing images, but today I will actually not talk about them specifically, but I hope you'll get why they're there. So I'll begin. Almost four decades before his reckoning with the life philosophy of the 19th century as a proto-fascist irrationalism of a destruction of reason, Georg Lukács wrote an obituary for Georg Simmel in which he described his former teacher as the greatest transitional philosopher of our age, or what for him amounted to the same as philosopher of impressionism. Simmel was the Monet of philosophy. For Lukács, however, it required a Cézanne, a new classicism of hard and rigid yet comprehensive forms to now complete the transitional phenomenon of impressionism, read Simmel. In turning away from Simmel's philosophy of life a few years later and towards a theory of alienation oriented at the early humanist Marx, Lukács seemed to want to become this Cézanne. For Lukács' contemporary Karl Einstein, however, Cézanne was by no means a conclusion nor an overcoming. The teleological construction of a continuous progression, according to which impressionism represents an evolutionary stage to be succeeded by another, more developed phase, was rejected by Einstein as early as 1910. He called it an unsubstantiated hypothesis of Darwinism and, above all, the catchword of progress that is so familiar to the proletarian. Unlike Lukács, history for Einstein was always determined by its contemporaneity, conceived as a repository of in which nothing was ever simply concluded or passed. It was less a system of precepts and ideal forms than a sum of possibilities or forms in becoming or declining. Consequently, for Einstein, the achievement of Cézanne's classical restoration of impressionism does not consist in stabilizing a finality of form, but rather in the crisis proneness of an incomplete form of a temporal interval that forced impressionism into what he called a tectonic primitive, which is also the idiom through which he will discuss cubism. Einstein's continuous engagement with non-Western and anti-modern forms of production and temporalization was explicitly articulated as an attack on the forms of capitalization of the art historical canon of Western Europe modernity, positioned against the bourgeois subject, the I for him was a mode of ownership, the self-contained art object and bourgeois reason. For him, and I quote, primitive art is the rejection of the capitalist heritage of art. It is a rupture in the Western European continuum of empty homogeneous time. And this is, of course, something that Maria Stravinsky has written more extensively about. Informed by what Félix Guattari would later call proto-aesthetic models of the constitution of form, Einstein's art theory draws on the collective, that is, cultic, religious foundations of art as a practice of form, whose transversality was only retrospectively narrowed down into the institutionalization of a modern concept of art. For Einstein, who, like Lukács, attended Georg Simmel's Berlin lectures, read Henri Bergson and Friedrich Nietzsche, it is not least in the context of the revision of academic formalist art history, in which not only ethnology, psychoanalysis, and the philosophy of science, but also the life philosophy of the late 19th century and early 20th century assumes a central, if quite ambivalent, position. Roughly speaking, life philosophy was the product of an age in which life evolved into a point of orientation for diverse tendency within science, the history of thought and culture, all of which strove to liberate themselves from the rationalism and historicism of the 18th century. As a deviation within the progressive logic of industrial modernity and its forms of capitalization and discipline, Lebensphilosophie was a rejection of what Georg Simmel called objective culture, a money-driven commodity based culture made by humans but increasingly alien to them. Life philosophy was an anti-modern tendency within modernity, a philosophy that revolted against philosophy. In a series appended to his Heritage of Our Times from 1934, a kaleidoscopic view on the multiple temporalities that crisis brought to the fore in interwar Germany, Ernst Bloch approached this philosophy as a mode of thought germane to a false present, a present traversed by the unresolved remnants of the past, of social forms and fantasies, of unquenched hopes rooted in different temporalities and histories. Germany, circa 1930, was a country full of people that lived out of sync with the capitalist timeline of a rationalized present, materially, culturally, and psychically. Bloch's term for this life out of sync is non-simultaneous contradiction. He distinguished between its subjective and objective form. The latter became manifest on the material level of economic and social structure. Germany was a country in which industrialization happened belatedly, but all the more rapidly and thoroughly. Unlike France and England, it was not accompanied by a bourgeois revolution. The authoritarian structures of the Prussian state remained largely intact. And so did the cultural belief systems of previous times, the occult, mystic, and conspirational beliefs that still shaped the lives and the life forms of large parts of the population. Clashing with the rhythm of the capitalist now, anxieties of social decline and pent-up anger congealed into subjective non-simultaneity, a sense of being socially and psychically uprooted. Oops. And that's the way we could think about it. Today, Bloch writes, in 1934, not even the economic substructures in these corners, the obsolete forms of production and exchange have passed away, let alone their ideological superstructures, let alone the genuine contents of yet not undefined erasure. The conceptual core of Heritage of Our Times consists in an analysis of these non-simultaneous contradictions and how far the forces of reaction, in contrast to the left, were able to mobilize the lived experience of such uneven development. The unfulfilled fairy tale of the good old times, the unresolved myth of dark ancient being of nature, represented in capitalist modernity a past that had not been materially overcome, yet whose present bourgeois liberal thought as much as orthodox Marxism remained blind. For Bloch, then, life philosophy became pertinent for at least two reasons. Firstly, because it was an articulate expression of non-simultaneous contradictions which materialized not least in the failures of its own aspirations, namely, and in brief, the vitalist critique of life's quantifications within the ossification of form, or form understood as the purview of the conceptual, the categorical, the numerical, jarred with its own scientificity as a philosophy. Or put differently, life philosophy was in non-simultaneous contradiction with itself. Its desire for emancipating life was by necessity undermined by its own scientificity, by its form. And secondly, his thought became significant as a differentiation, or rather materialization, of Bloch's own investment in vitalism. At the time of A Spirit of Utopia from 1918, published at the close of the First World War and at the high end point of the Expressionist Revolt, of which he was an ardent advocate, he was still a diehard Expressionist vitalist. If Heritage of Our Times was kaleidoscopic or ornamental in style, it had boundaries. Spirit of Utopia was a sprawling phenomenology, a stream of consciousness modeled on what Bloch called schnitzhaftes Denken, carving-like kind of thinking. It searched to grasp, or indeed to carve out, the expression of a phenomenon in the manner that for him Franz Marc, one of his favorite painters, did, rather than to delineate its contours sharply. And here's what such carving of thought reads like, and apologies, it's only in German, but the English translation gave the whole thing more definition or form than it actually had. So by the time of the Expressionist debate in the early 1930s, however, fought most vigorously with his former friend Lukács, Bloch's sprawling, elusive form of writing had changed. His qualification of Expressionism as suffering from, quote, a neglect of form, from a plethora of expressions crudely, wildly, or chaotically ejaculated, reads basically like a comment on his own Expressionist vitalism. Its stigma was amorphousness. Nonetheless, Bloch didn't buy into Lukács' naturalist view on art that was to lay bare the subject's position within capital. This was a notion of the subject as an ideal type with fixed boundaries, like a neoclassicist work of art, Lukács' favorite mode of realism, glossed over contradictions. Bloch dismissed Lukács' procedure as one that derives concepts from concepts, and in a different frame, Einstein would later speak quite aptly about a pictorial positivism. Nor did Bloch share Michael Loewy's later formulated hope for salvaging the notion of an emancipated subject a remnant from Romanticism that by the 1930s was no longer livable, persisting merely as a lost ideal, an empty form. And I will say a bit more about that empty form later. So instead of giving up entirely on his earlier vitalism, he attempted to channel it differently, which is to say he wanted to give it more form. His expressionist subject was conceived as a kind of blend between the individual and the collective, the organic and the constructed, with the ornament as its medium. And this is something that we could think about in relation to. As Bloch already stipulated, in the spirit of utopia, the ornament was not mimicry of organicism, but a form that came into being artificially through construction, but gained a life of its own. The ornament was a life form that was by necessity incomplete, potentially open to further transformation. As such, it bears resemblance to Karl Einstein's own version of a fractured vitalism that can be traced from his early work, the novel Babuken unter die Dilettanten des Wunders from 1912, to one of his last published books on Braque from the early 30s, and my notes today will concern only the latter, actually. Like Bloch's theory of non-simultaneous contradiction, Einstein's metamorphotic, and here we'll only actually focus on one register. We heard earlier from Tom that the notion is actually quite expansive and multivalent. Nonetheless, like Bloch's theory of non-simultaneous contradictions, Einstein's metamorphotic can be understood as an indictment of Marxism for having ceded the legacy of irrationalism and Lebensphilosophie to fascist colonization. Instead of mobilizing the anti-systemic elements of these currents and effective powers politically. In his Braque book, which to be sure is not a book about Braque, and this is something that Charles Haxhausen will talk about in a moment, he writes programmatically that society is determined not only by economic forces, but equally by social myth, to which he, in contrast to the orthodox Marxists, ascribes the most powerful reality, in whose embodiments he sees materialized in art, among other places. In the consumer culture of Western Europe, the automatism of the technological economy, in whose progressive potential scientific Marxism remained invested, was one that fatally determined the helpless human, writes Einstein. In place of scientific Marxism's focus on labor and technology, Einstein introduced the vitalist figure of the metamorphotic. As an automatism of the hallucinatory, it described an eternally productive process of form transformation, a kind of retooled productivism that divested itself of the centrality of the Marxist concept of labor and of progress. For Einstein, as much as for Bloch, scientific orthodox Marxism, investment in synchronicity and technological modernity was blind to the non-simultaneous affects and utopian desires that shaped life in the 1930s, and in Germany in particular. Both shared an interest in life philosophy, not least because it brought to the fore how modernity was damaged goods from the start. Instead of mourning the failed completion of its so-called emancipatory project in a romantic anti-capitalist vein, Einstein and Bloch cultivated the materialism of its failure as a living form. And it is also precisely on account of this problem of form that Bloch's own deliberations on life philosophy, and actually much like Einstein's, were resolutely polemical rather than a sober scientific assessment of its flaws or virtues. He, for instance, speaks of Raubtier philosophy, a philosophy of the prey animal, Tarzan philosophy, weekend philosophy, and so on. Unlike Georges Bataille and Bloch's peers at the Institute of Social Research in Frankfurt, who in the 1930s endeavored to salvage Nietzsche's philosophy from its appropriation by the Nazis, Bloch was not concerned with the philosophical redemption of Lebensphilosophy, with preserving the tradition of a European intellectual history in which vitalism and fascism were not allowed to collapse into one another. His was not an intellectual rescue mission, not a systemic critique, but an attempt to write against it, to make palpable in and through writing that the form with which to approach the question of life and vitality is inextricable from the question itself. For Bloch, this question of aesthetic remained one that was largely bound to one of expression, for instance, in the figure of the ornament, while for Einstein it rather consisted in negating or evacuating expression in a process of decomposition in what he called metamorphotics, and something I will return to in a moment again. And here, as a side note, one should note that life philosophy was not at all opposed to the living, but to the sign, or more precisely, to form, which of course doesn't mean that its notion of the living were not racialized, and authors like Christopher Bracken and Donna Jones have persuasively shown how. But life philosophy's central prohibition and hence desire was not the vitality, the animation of the sign, which for Christopher Bracken serves as a central trait of Western European thought as what he calls savage philosophy. To clarify what Bracken means by that is, what he means by savage philosophy does not primarily designate animistic or occult practices, but rather points to the vitalist undercurrent of discursive Western logic itself. Savage philosophy, he writes, is an outgrowth of Western discourse and its racialization of ideas. Thus, when Europeans speak of savages, they essentially speak about themselves. Yet because Bracken posits the animation of the sign as a prohibited desire across Western Europe thought, Nietzsche, Freud, Marx, and others, it threatens to turn into an anthropological constant that loses specificity, as well as sight of the function not of animation, but of the sign, or as I would prefer to say, loses sight of form. Form, one might argue, is precisely that which remained unthought in life philosophy, and that which in turn defined it profoundly. Form not only is a material boundary which delimits the temporality of becoming, or as discourse say, but also is that which regulates or administers the rhythm of life's flow, which determines vitality internally. As the socially immaterially defined negativity immanent to capitalist life, from which life philosophy strove to rid itself, form thus could be understood as Vitalism's very own unconscious, or, to put it in Peter Gorzon's terms, because vitalism does not think the form of life, it presupposes the formalization of capitalist life. Its abstraction of life, its avowed formlessness, always already presupposes the abstraction of capital. Bloch understood as much when he wrote about the incessant, bustling movement of Bergson's Élan Vital as an entrepreneurial zest. It belongs to a bourgeoisie which trivializes its contradictions, which places the matter of its growing alienation on the debit account of the whole universe in order to bear it more easily, which leaps over the dialectic of its destruction with a salto vitale. Thus, the zest remains empty, becomes an antithesis which strikes sideways out into the jungle and makes itself absolute without content. The naturalization of bourgeois life as vitalized form for Bloch ultimately amounts to an aesthetics of primitivization, to an aesthetization of the primal, which is to say it amounts to a detemporalization. Accordingly, he described the sole inhabitant of the self-made vitalist jungle as the faltering bourgeois subject of Western Europe. It came in the shape of an animal of prey or as Nietzsche's Dionysos, as an aesthetic subject, that is, and I quote, Dionysos is an indeterminate being beside oneself, being outside time per se. What Bloch thereby described was the space of the aesthetic and its subject, because life philosophy was a bourgeois theory of alienation in the sense that it did not aim at recovering experience, but bourgeois experience, the experience of a certain class. Art assumed a central role therein. Premised on an understanding of capitalism as a kind of natural history, as an evolution that is inevitable, from a vitalist perspective, its consequences, namely alienation, could be deplored, but they could not be changed. They were perceived as tragic rather than historic. Hence the necessity of art. Because the bourgeois subject lost its space of freedom, it needed art to simulate the freedom that it could no longer claim for itself materially. Take, for instance, Georg Simmel's 1911 essay on the sculpture of Auguste Rodin. At the case of Rodin, Simmel stipulated the de-alienating potential that he ascribed to art as its ability to grant repose from change and contradiction, which, however, was to be obtained not only by taking refuge in whatever represents the contrary of such agitation, but first and foremost in the most perfect stylization and the most intensified purity of the content of this reality. Which is to say that art's task was not to do with away with alienation, it was tragic effect to be accepted, but to render it aesthetic. Within art, the romantic free subject could be held artificially alive, because its freedom was merely metaphysical and its lived experience existed only as boundary. The subject was itself a non-simultaneous contradiction, a kind of animated fossil, a dead form living. Conceived as a space of freedom, art simulated an end to the painfully lived experience of non-simultaneity that had riven the fabric of life in 1930, cutting across social, cultural, and subject forms. Stripped of the materiality of lived unevenness, it simulated a presence, an instantaneity, that could be constructed only at the expense of space, of lived material space. For aesthetic space does not know the passage of time. It is an artificial, fossilized jungle. It's time spatialized. When Bloch, inheritors of our time, wrote that the primacy of space over time in general is an infallible characteristic of reactionary language, and he was thinking of illustrated magazines and books like this, in contrast to a focus on time in left-wing papers, his emphasis lay on language, thus pointing to the aesthetic register that would become central in fascism. And it is not against, or not at least against, this backdrop that one should consider Karl Einstein's assault on the aesthetics of an academic art history as a metaphysical detemporalized space. For him, this was not only an epistemological problem, but an existential and political one. Art history was the struggle of all optical experiences, he wrote. Einstein confronted art history's petrification of objects and subject in aesthetic space with a materialist understanding of art as a living form, was animated by his fractured or delimited vitalism of the metamorphotic. The notion of the metamorphotic, as Einstein envisioned it, had nothing to do with Bergson's notion of a metaphysical primordial time that Einstein out of hand dismissed as too childishly positive in conception. Instead of identifying sensation of time and subjectivity with dynamics, he argues in his Brackbuch that, other than Bergson believes, it is precisely in the process in which the bearer of the time, the I, dies off. Arguably, for Einstein, art was at its best precisely not as a space of the free romantic subject, but of its damaged form, of the subject as a non-simultaneous contradiction, a persisting anachronism. Because this subject could not be done away with by fiat, how do you get rid of non-simultaneity or dead form living? What the acts of the metamorphotic in the artwork ought to bring to the fore was what Einstein called vibrant mortality and death intensity. Thank you.